Don't you know? We're talking about a revolution. Sounds.
It's the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, here with co-host Bill Westmiller. Today is Thursday, September 19, 2013, and here is a list of some of the headlines we'll be looking at today. We're going to get back to some monetary issues, including raising the question, is there a global credit bubble, and how big is it compared to the 2007-2008 bubble? We'll also look at the TARP payback. And was it really a payback, as well as what the impact of the U.S. debt was? We'll look at Bitcoin. We'll also take a look at the NSA, because revelations have been coming out, as is per usual. It looks like the Snowden plan is working, constantly feeding the news beast, this time talking about the NSA tapping into Visa transactions. Oh, what a surprise there. And we'll also have something from the Electronic Frontier Foundation and ask the question about what happens with Germany and Israel, where the NSA are concerned. And we'll look at the Syria Weapons Convention signing and what happens both with that and with the so-called deal to track down and take control of the chemical weapons that Syria has held all these years. We'll also look at some skeptical analysis of that, including our friend Charles Faddis, the former case officer for the CIA, who wrote an article at andmagazine.com on the subject. And if we can, we'll also get to a couple other things, including some funny stuff from The Onion. But we're going to start off today with some revelations that came out today, minor ones by most people's reckoning, but J.P. Morgan, in the case known as the Whale Deal, was basically involved in a lawsuit with the SEC. That lawsuit has been settled, at least to some degree, to the extent that they're now on the hook for a grand total of $920 million, not to mention all the losses they incurred in the process of all that. And while this is significant in one sense because it involves those famous old friends of ours, credit default swaps, which were particularly involved with the financial crisis in 2008, it is actually more interesting from my perspective, Bill, because of all the things that the SEC isn't investigating where J.P. Morgan is concerned.
Yeah, I'm still trying to figure out what a London whale is.
It turns out a London whale is a trader. Isn't that kind of interesting?
Yeah,
they actually name the traders.
One guy by the name of Bruno Ixel.
Say that one three times.
Who apparently was investing in the CDSs, and it looks like he may have lost $9 billion for J.P. Morgan when it's all accumulated over the period of a couple of years. I mean, there's a long history of all these CDSs, and they're not even sure the degree is, what they were credit default swaps for. So it's a confusing scandal, and I'm sure the FEC is delighted to get a settlement, but less than $1 billion when they apparently lost $9 billion for investors. It seems like only a superficial fix, but J.P. Morgan has been spanked publicly, and they seem to be very upset about what transpired and the misrepresentations that were involved and fraud, put it plain and simple, by their traders who were... One aspect was this apparent division in J.P. Morgan was selling these default swaps to another division of J.P. Morgan, and that division was losing the money to the other division of J.P. Morgan. So it's a terrible mess. It was they call it a derivative of derivatives, which means people were investing in the possibility that other people's investments were going to fail because the underlying stock in the derivative was in bad shape.
It's
worse than Vegas. It sounds like Vegas.
Well, yeah, but it's nice to know that our banks engage in these sober, well-thought-out, well-backed, calculated investments that are safe for their investors, don't you think?
I can imagine going to Vegas and doing a little, setting up a little side bet if they allowed that, saying, which one of these guys is going to win at the craps table? You know, let's place bets on who's going to win at the craps table. And then setting up another side table saying, who on the side table is going to win or lose? It's so crazy. We talked about this at some length before about these credit default swaps. But basically, they depended on one thing, and that was the monopoly on credit ratings, which was granted by the federal government to three corporations, Standard & Poor's and two others. And basically, they were the ones that supposedly actually looked at the contract and understood what these credit default swaps were and gave them a credit rating. And that's the whole premise for getting away with basically theft and robbery of investors, was these government-authorized, certified risk evaluators. So that's the key to not just this incident, but the entire 2009-2008 fiasco. It was that the estimates of risk involved in these investments was a total fabrication. Nobody understood what was going on.
Including the investors, apparently.
Well, the investors were just bouncing around looking at recent history. I mean, if you go to Fidelity, they got like 40 or 50 different mutual funds. And you can look at the history over the past, 3 months or 6 months or 2 years or 5 years. And the people that want to make a lot of money look at the 3 months, ignore everything else, and say, well, it's gone up in the past 3 months, so the chances are it's going to go up for the next 3 months. Of course, your results may vary.
Well, you mentioned that there's a similarity to Las Vegas, but I think that's actually an unfair comparison because in Vegas you actually have a chance to win. I mean,
and the house, if you equate that to the bank, always wins.
I mean, it's kind of like saying that you have a chance to win in the same way that you have a chance of winning the lottery. You know, have you spent your $5 on the Powerball? You know, that kind of thing.
Well, the amusing part is that the house is losing. J.P. Morgan is losing. I mean, all these traders and investors and people who are creating and fabricating all these stupid pieces of paper were making lots of commission because J.P. Morgan was paying him up front for the investments. But the house lost. that's news. That's not Vegas at all.
No, it's not Vegas at all. But it's a good point that you raise, and one that occurred to me also. And I guess the thing that catches my attention the most about it is, well, first of all, they lost all the money. Second of all, they've been fined a small amount for losing all the money. And third of all, no one seems to be concerned about why they were losing money. I mean, that's the part that's really interesting to me.
That's why I pointed out.
What it basically suggests here is that their goal was not earning money. Their goal was not making money, and they weren't even concerned about losing money. They had a different goal. So the question is, what was that goal? Because, it's not like these guys are all incompetent. I mean, they get their jobs and they get the trading accounts because they're pretty darn good at it.
I think all it is they're just short-sighted. In other words, the traders that are involved in these credit default swaps, these guys like the London Whale, this one trader, they don't care. They don't care whether the investment is good or bad, it's going to make money or isn't going to make money. As long as they sell it and get their commission, that's all they care about. And what Morgan Stanley is talking about now is a clawback of some of those bonuses and commissions that the traders got for selling these things. Well, the traders, look at it, I'm going to sell, as much as I can, and I don't care whether it's going to make money for an investor or not. I'm going to turn it over, and I'm going to collect my commission, and in another year, I'll be gone. I'll have my $2 million in the bank. I don't care what happens to the actual investment. And that's the psychology.
Here's the thing, though. Morgan Chase, to the best of my knowledge, now I can't say I've read up on all the details of this, but to the best of my knowledge, they haven't fired Bruno Ixil, nor have they fired any of the other traders who are involved.
Now, well, they're talking about clawbacks.
If are truly severe losses that are adversely affecting the bank, I would think they'd want to do that, wouldn't they?
Well, they're talking about clawbacks. In other words, they've got a contract, and they probably put stipulations in there over the course of the years to be able to retract commissions paid and bonuses paid and so on. So maybe they're only keeping them on board, you know, legally, so that they can use the clawback provisions in their contracts. But I don't know. Yeah,
there's no way that they're going to recover the loss on that.
No.
And certainly, if even if that was the strategy, certainly you'd announce that they'd been, you know, suspended. Probably suspended without pay, something along that line, whatever the equivalent is in the trading community.
I hadn't followed the story that closely. But what I do find interesting is that a year and a half ago, or when we were in the middle of this, a couple of years ago, when all the ruckus was going on, kind of in the background, the Treasury took away the monopolies that Standard & Poor's and Moody's and so on had. There were only three of them. And in the course of about 3 months, they authorized an additional 12 people who were going to rate all these different investments. So they've kind of quietly been backing away from the monopoly, which in my opinion was the primary cause for the whole disaster in the first place.
Well, I'm not sure it's the primary cause, but it certainly contributed.
It was fraud. It was misrepresentation to the investors that these people had actually done a serious job of understanding what the investment was and calculating the risks. And they weren't.
Well, yeah, I agree with that. Also fraud to expand the money supply, pretend that you're not expanding it, pretend that it's not debasing the money supply, and then using that money to basically, you know, build up the mortgage market and the stock market, and then thereby create a derivatives market. Yeah, that's fraud, too. But I think the second one actually is fraud.
I agree. Yeah, I mean, it is fraud. But in terms of the specific, you know, these credit default swaps and stuff like that could have occurred and did occur, even when there wasn't a massive federal intervention.
Yeah, they just can't bring down the economy. You got to have the logic changer where you can start bringing down the economy.
Well, in a way, all this stupidity and incompetence bolsters the Fed's claim to more power. They can do pretty much anything they want. For a long time, the Fed had real serious restrictions on where they put the money. Use this fabricated fiat money to buy treasury bonds. Well, and they're still doing that. They've quadrupled and multiplied by 10 or 20 the amount that they're doing in terms of buying U.S. treasuries. At the same time, they've put an equal amount, billions, I think it's $20 billion a month or some ridiculous number like that, into Fannie and Freddie Mae to keep it bolstered up so that there's the illusion that the housing market isn't the disaster that it actually was. So there's, those are all factors that are, you know, relevant.
And I think probably the most remarkable fact of all is, despite the fact that the bank books losses, the bank itself never actually loses anything. You ever notice that?
You never what?
The bank never actually loses anything. I mean, it's not like, of their own, I mean. It's not like they were putting their own money at risk. It's not like the directors or the CEO or anybody like that were putting their own money. They're risking everybody else's money and then taking a piece of the pie every step of the way. So, but yeah, the only thing they lost is the golden goose.
Yeah, they just don't want people to discover what's going on.
Yeah.
But when they do discover what's going on, then they have losses. They had
but it doesn't. It isn't a loss that affects them. It's not like they're coughing up anything. That's what I'm saying.
Oh yeah. I mean, their stock prices takes a dive, and the number of people who are willing to invest takes a dive, and so their prospects for the future are
they can't continue to squeeze that particular goose for more golden eggs. So they have to go to another golden goose.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what's known as a loss in banking circles. Which were so for those of us who actually had to work for a living. But the point that I was trying to get at earlier, though, about the fact that essentially, and this is where the criminal investigations are pointing, by the way, essentially this is a question of whether or not the bank was knowingly losing money and not really giving a darn about that because they had another agenda. The announcements about what the criminal investigations are about are pretty limited in terms of what they tell us. They really don't tell us much of anything at all, to be perfectly honest. But what they do say is that there are criminal investigations underway and that they do involve the question of whether or not the bank knowingly was engaging in these losses, which is another way of saying, yeah, we knew the losses were occurring. We just didn't do anything about them because we had other things on our mind. So the question becomes, what were those other things? And personally, I'd like to see the same kind of investigation spread out. I'd like to see them find something, first of all, within the CDS. That'd be great. But even more beyond that, I'd like to see them expand it because it's become very clear to me anyway. Now, you may disagree, but it's become very clear to me that J.P. Morgan, certainly among others, but they're a leader in the United States as far as I'm concerned. They have led the way in terms of manipulating all kinds of markets. I would say that the precious metal markets have been heavily influenced. I know you're not quite in agreement on that, but I think we could probably agree that they've definitely been influencing the bond markets in as many ways as they possibly can. And in fact, that's pretty much now public knowledge. There aren't too many people who disagree with that aspect of it. Apparently, they've been manipulating the credit default swaps and the derivatives markets. It makes me wonder, are there any markets of any major size that they haven't been manipulating?
Yeah, well, you know, it's... I don't know how many people recall, but a couple back, there was a trader who notified the FEC or whoever it was in the government that was supposed to be SEC about the fraud involved in these credit default swaps. And he sent them letters for months and months on end. He said, this is crazy. This is nonsense. This is, you know, obviously fraud. And the SEC did nothing.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Literally ignored this trader who had it right on the money in terms of exactly what was going on. So the SEC, I mean, you look at the people who are running the government agencies that are supposed to be monitoring us, they are all alumni of Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan and EIG and so on and so forth. I mean, these are the handmaidens of the banks that are supposed mm-hmm. to be running these regulatory agencies.
Yep.
And they're utterly incompetent. They're either incompetent or malicious, one of the two. Take your pick.
Well, certainly incompetence has a malicious aspect to it when incompetence is placed in powerful authorities at such a high level, people who, in theory, should know better.
Yeah, well, I mean... you know, the only people who got what they deserved in the financial crisis were the Lehman Brothers, who ended up closing and going to the Bank for International Settlements. One of our stories is interesting because it says that the global credit bubble that exists today is bigger than it was in 2007. Extreme forms of credit excess across the world, worldwide, have reached or surpassed the levels seen shortly before the Lehman crisis 5 years ago, according to the Bank of International Settlements. One of their chief economists says this looks to me like 2007 all over again, but even worse.
Mm.
Which means we're we're not looking at recession times. We're looking at serious depression and a serious prospect of the markets taking another nosedive. Not just the U.S., but worldwide.
Did the report give any details about what the source was this time? Last time it was basically the subprime mortgages and the mortgage market as a whole. Is it still mortgages or has it expanded to other areas?
They're describing it as total public and private debt levels are 30% higher as a share of GDP in the advanced economies than they were back then. They've added a whole new problem with bubbles in emerging markets that are ending in a boom-bust cycle. And the housing bust was one bust, and these leveraged loans and leveraged buyouts and CDSs and CDRs, they're even worse than they were before.
By the way, you mentioned the Lehman Brothers were the only ones who really paid any penalty, but really they didn't either. I mean, it's not like
they... Well, I mean, they went bankrupt. They had to go into receivership and basically dissolve the company.
But the brothers didn't get affected.
Oh, well,
I mean, it's not like
maybe not directly.
Private assets, you know, seized and distributed to investors or anything like that.
Yeah, well, I mean, not directly, but I'm sure all of those executives had, like, a majority of their stock portfolios in their own companies.
Well, yeah.
And so when the companies went bankrupt, the value of their stock took a nosedive. So I guess they got a penalty indirectly.
Indirectly, yeah. But most of their ill-gotten booty, they kept. I like changing around. But most of that they kept. So saying that they paid a penalty, that goes back to what I was talking about before. You know, the bankers never actually pay a penalty. What they do is they lose the golden goose, and they lost the golden goose.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not like they did an Enron.
True. Well, you know what it is. I think there's an interesting incongruity in the U.S. government system. For decades, centuries even, all of the economic regulation, whether it was insurance or investment or banking or whatever, was controlled entirely by the states. And over the course of those decades, the federal government has taken over more and more and more and more in order to standardize it and theoretically make it better. Of course, the consequence of that has been the big crash of 2007, the crash of the housing market. It's a worse disaster than it's ever been. So the federal government taking over with their wisdom and intelligence and supercomputers and everything else is on the basis of the evidence a absolute and total failure. But there's still that competition even between the federal and the state regulators, even on insurance, which, you know, gets us into this whole Obamacare thing, where it's a split between the feds and the states. The states may run an exchange, maybe they don't. The Fed runs it, Fed subsidizes it, or they don't, or whoever. You know, it's a total boondoggle. And as a consequence, nobody is ever responsible for any bad effects. And it isn't just banking corporations, it's bureaucrats and politicians that make these decisions, never suffer the consequences. And because in our law, it isn't perfectly clear what constitutes fraud. And so when they go to prosecute these cases, it's extremely rare that they have criminal prosecutions, that they said, you committed fraud, you lied, you misrepresented, we're going to put you in jail. It just doesn't happen. I think out of the whole 2007-2008 financial crisis, there were something like two or three traders, you know, low-level traders, who ended up in prison for a short period of time. Mm-hmm. And none of the executives who obviously knew what was going on, you know, were criminally prosecuted. And it may be in some respects that, you know, these bankers and investors and so on and so forth who basically had various state capitals in their pockets and now have the Fed, you know, regulators in their pockets. And they're basically running the regulators. So it's a situation where they're covering their ass, not just financially, but criminally. The prosecutions for fraud are almost non-existent.
And I think it's fair to say that not only prosecutions of the bankers are non-existent, the prosecution of the regulators is even more non-existent. The people who are protecting us.
Yeah, like I said, one of the primary causes of the whole collapse in 2007-2008 were the credit rating agencies. Well, nobody in the credit rating agency is ever going to go to jail for making a totally false misrepresentation of the value of a security.
The credit rating agencies are also theoretically private. I'm talking about the government regulators themselves, the guys who are supposed to be watching all this stuff, who are supposed to be acting on our behalf, making sure that, you know, we're getting a fair shake in the marketplace and all that. And they weren't doing it. And like you pointed out, even when somebody was whistleblowing out, they still weren't doing it. And that, to me, is much more severe than what even the bankers and the ratings agencies were doing, because the government's the one that's supposed to be protecting us, right? That's what the theory is. That's the way the whole thing's supposed to work. And they weren't doing it. And not only were they not doing it, no one cares. None of the politicians care. Of course not, because they're the ones who the bureaucrats are working for. None of the the top people in any of the circles, none of the media, none of them care. And that, to me, is the most striking thing of all, where this whole crazy nonsense is concerned. The regulators are not held accountable.
Well, that's because the existing law, as it stands, makes every regulator totally immune from prosecution for any act they did in an official capacity.
Right.
Even if they totally screwed everything up, even if they totally, you know, ignored their mandates, totally, you know, perverted their entire system for the benefit of friends or allies or whatever, they have legal immunity from anything they do, which is almost the case now for bankers and investment companies. They basically have criminal immunity. They can't.
That has to change, because if the regulators always have immunity, they will never have any incentive to do the job right.
Right. They're not, well, they're not responsible for what they do.
No. They have no responsibility at all. I mean, in theory, I suppose they're responsible to the Congress, but they're a more irresponsible organization than the Congress.
Yeah. No, it's a sad story, and I think it's beginning to dawn on people in general that putting your future of your economy and monetary and everything else in the hands of a bunch of bureaucrats is not putting it into the hands of wise and disciplined legal arbiters of what's right and what's wrong. It's just a game. It's just a game. And they play the game and they take home their salary or their bonus or whatever it is. And people get hurt, tough.
Plato's Republic takes another blow. Well, before we leave the whole concept of the monetary topics, because we haven't touched on them for quite a while, one last thing we should touch on is TARP, because TARP, of course, was supposed to be a major part of, you know, making the ship right again, fixing the fact that the regulators had kind of been asleep on the job, and fixing the fact that the rating agencies had given us the wrong information, and fixing the fact that the bankers had basically taken themselves to cleaners, and yada, 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 on and on and on. And the big claim, of course, about TARP was that, well, not only was it going to work, but we were going to get all our money back. The taxpayers weren't going to be risking a dime. And, in fact, the news reports told us that, yes, TARP all got paid back, or virtually all got paid back. But did it really?
Well, in Vegas, the characteristic game is the shell game, where you're never quite sure where the P is, and you bet.
Actually, I believe that's 42nd Street in New York, but I understand your point.
Well, it's kind of a iconic characterization of gambling. And basically, that's what's happened with the TARP funds. You don't know where that debt is because it gets shuffled around all over the place. Right now, the Fed owns all of the or almost all of the debt of Fed, Fannie, and Freddie Mac. The Fed owns all of the or the majority now of U.S. Treasury bonds. So you don't know where the debt is. It's kind of disappeared into this black hole, and it's the same case with the TARP. There was a big hullabaloo that General Motors was now profitable. Well, the reason why they're profitable is because they paid back the TARP loan by borrowing money from the Commerce Department to pay back the loan and get the money from the Commerce Department at a reduced rate, even below the Fed rate, which made their books balance very nicely. But it's still a debt, and it's still an obligation of the U.S. government to guarantee it. And that's the case not just with General Motors, but with a lot of these investment houses. The debt has been hidden well. But it's just shuffled from one area of the government to another area of the government, whether it's the Fed or the Commerce Department or whoever it might be.
Well, we're nearly halfway through with the program. Let's take a break. And after the break, We'll put the monetary issues aside, and we'll take a look at what's going on with the NSA and the latest revelations there. And we'll also touch on Syria and what the reality and truth is behind the search for chemical weapons. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we will be right back. We're back here on the Freedom News Hour, Walt Thiessen and Bill Westmiller. And Bill, the news continues to come out from The Guardian and from other sources that Edward Snowden shared his information with in his whistleblowing mission that have been revealing more and more about how the NSA taps into every aspect of human life. Within the last couple of weeks, we talked about how the attacks on encryption and the ability of the NSA to basically break encryption because of longstanding tactics they have followed to essentially weaken encryption and make it possible for them to break through on it. That we speculated that was going to lead to revelations about being able to tap into the e-commerce trade and transactions that happen online. Well, we didn't have to wait very long on that one, did we?
No. Although the most recent revelations are not Snowden revelations. I mentioned this offhandedly during our discussion with Charles Faddis last week, but the Electronic Freedom Foundation filed suit because the government had refused a Freedom of Information request. And finally, the court said, look, turn this over. At least, turn over the old stuff from 2006 to 2009. And apparently what was happening was that the NSA had what they called an alert list. It was a list of phone numbers that they thought were somehow related to terrorism. Well, in 2006, it was about 4,000 names on this list. They ran it every day against the entire metadata list from the U.S. and the world and extracted all this information. Well, it grew from 2006 to 2009 up to nearly 18,000 names on this alert list. Well, as the court determined and demanded to know, how many of these were in compliance with the rules and regulations that NSA had agreed to? Well, it turned out that out of 16,000, only 2,000 met the standards that the NSA said they were applying. That means there were 16,000 names on this alert list that didn't have any justification whatsoever, but all of their phone data, not just the metadata, but the actual conversations, was being extracted by the NSA. Now, after the court slapped them on the hands three times for lying to the court, the FISA court, the NSA finally said, okay, we're shutting down the alert list. This was in 2009. So they released everything on this one program that they closed down 4 years ago, but nothing since then. So we don't know whether or not there was some variation or some other program that took over this kind of a task, or they just, changed the procedure. But it's interesting to read the court documents where the court is basically saying, hey, you guys have lied to us. For 3 years, you've lied to us about what you're supposedly doing, and you're taking information that's obviously a violation of the law and the Constitution. So stop it already. So that was kind of the big revelation, although it didn't get a lot of attention. It's a fascinating insight into the very secret manipulation of the court by the NSA. Well, but you had another topic. I missed the...
Well, that's right. The other revelation that came out during the past week or so was that the NSA has been actively tracking Visa transactions online, which ties into the encryption method that I was mentioning earlier. And the fact is that apparently, well, let's see what the Spiegel.de had a report out. They said the collected information flowed into the NSA's financial data bank, which they call TrackFin, which in 2011 contained 180 million records. Some 84% of the data is from credit card transactions. And so there's the verification that I was alluding to, that in fact they've been putting the ability to crack encryption to good use. They have, well, good depending on your point of view. They have been applying it to
actually tracking people and their transactions through this TrackIn program. Now, 180 million records, that's a large number. It's actually not a huge number when you consider how many transactions are conducted on the net. My suspicion is that, well, I guess calling this a suspicion is probably an understatement, but my suspicion is that this is the proverbial tip of the iceberg, that we're going to hear about a whole lot more that they've been digging up out of their ability to crack the encryption code.
Yeah. Well, there's an aspect of this that actually came to light a year or two ago, which was essentially that the central clearing, international clearinghouse for all inter-country, international transactions was collecting all this data, and there was a back door that the British intelligence service was able to go in and extract all this information directly from this clearinghouse. So they had, well, in the same story, a huge bulk data, a rich personal information, which had nothing whatever to do with terrorism. Mm. But they were getting access to all this information and passing it along through the British intelligence to the NSA.
Right.
And so basically, what we're going to just, you know, find out somewhere along the way is that it wasn't just 180 million records, even if most of those were credit card transactions. They're getting everything. I mean, everything, every financial transaction, and this is a result of the laws passed a decade ago, know your customer. When you go to the bank, you got to fill out all this form and give your social security number and your date of birth, and they have authority to record and report to any legally authorized source all of the information about your financial transactions. So every penny you spend is traceable by the NSA.
And isn't that wonderful?
Marvelous. Just marvelous.
Now, a couple of other things that have kind of started to leak out. It became apparent, I guess, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, something like that, that some of our allies were being spied upon by the NSA, and that did raise some eyebrows and so forth. But now it looks like maybe Germany wasn't being spied on. What, were they or weren't they?
No, they were. They were being spied on. But see, Germany was not one of the five eyes. Remember we talked about this with Charles? The five eyes are the United States, Britain, Canada, Australia, and I have no idea why, New Zealand. And they share all of the information, which means the French didn't get it. The Germans didn't get it. But those five eyes got everything, you know. They got all the snooping information, and they exchanged it among themselves. So what happened was Germany got into a schnit, not just because of spying on German, you know, politicians and bureaucrats, but because they were actually spying on diplomatic meetings. When the Germans went to a diplomatic meeting, they were tapped by the NSA. And the NSA collected all these, you know, all this wiretap information without any knowledge, you know, by the Germans or the French or Italians or anybody else that this was going on, just so Obama and his crew at the State Department would know exactly what their positions were on all these different financial issues in Syria and any other issue that was being discussed in these diplomatic conferences. They were basically all being wiretapped. Well, Germany made enough of a stink that the NSA agreed that they were not going to be collecting information from German transactions. They've agreed to negotiate an arrangement to which neither state will spy on the other for government or industrial purposes. So that was kind of nice that we did that for Germany. I'm sure France is having a conniption fit, as well as Italy and a dozen other countries in Europe. Kind of in the shadows of the whole Snowden thing is all the tapping the NSA has been doing in South America. And Glenn Greenwald has been writing articles in Spanish for the South American audience, explaining that, you know, all of their communications are going, whether the internet or phone, are going through U.S. switches, and the NSA taps them. Whether it's a government agency or an individual or a business or whatever it is. And so they are in a big huff as well. So it's...
But given the history of the NSA, particularly over the last 3 or 4 months as all these revelations have come out, and leading up to that period when all the denunciations and denials and so forth were being issued to Congress and so forth, given the fact that they really haven't been straight with us on anything, why should Germany believe that that immunity actually amounts to anything?
Well, you know, all the NSA has done is said, you know, we don't want you to be upset. You know, let's sit down and talk about this, and let's, you know, come to some agreement. And it isn't changing any of their policies or procedures. Just saying, let's talk about it. You know, contrary to a totally different country, Israel, where we do not tap their communications, but they get all of our NSA raw metadata, every single bit of it, including communications among government officials in the United States and so on. And the agreement with Israel is that they get everything we have anytime they want it. And it's all raw data, not selective, you know, based on terrorism or anything else, with the understanding that if they happen to notice that they're looking at a communication between officials of the U.S. government, that they should destroy those communications.
Just again, I raise the same question. Why should we believe that it is a unilateral arrangement?
The NSA
has a long history of lying. Why should we believe that the NSA is not tapping Israel?
Well, because we have a special relationship with Israel. I mean, why would we be sending them all of our metadata? Well, we don't even do that for Germany. We don't do that for Italy. But we send everything to Israel.
Even if we buy into the whole idea that that all the data is unilateral, it's going from us to them and not in reverse, even if we buy into that, why isn't that upsetting to the pro-Israel lobby?
Why isn't that upsetting? Because the whole purpose of the United States is to protect Israel and give Israel what it wants.
But the pro-Israel lobby have told us repeatedly that our national security interest is vested in our relationship with Israel. One would think they'd be concerned about giving over national secrets to the Israelis unilaterally. I mean, that's the sticky wicket that's in all this.
Well... Here's the thing. As far as Israel is concerned and the State Department is concerned, it is in the U.S. national interest to do everything possible that we can to benefit Israeli national interests. And that goes even so far as the Syrian situation and so on. It is not in the Israelis' national interest to protect the United States. It's only a one-way street, and always has been a one-way street.
My point here is, doesn't this demonstrate that the hardliners, the people who say that we have to basically be pro-Israel at all costs, yada, 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 doesn't it prove that all of their other noise about national interest, national security, and so forth is a bunch of hot air?
Well, the phrase national security interests has no meaning whatsoever. Nobody ever defines it. They just assume
it does have emotional meaning. And in this context, it strikes me that there is an emotional meaning that contradicts that emotional meaning, and that's what's interesting.
Yeah, explain that to me.
Well, like I said, if the pro-Israel lobby, and I think it's pretty easy to draw this broad generalization about them. If that pro-Israel lobby can be sort of broad-brushed into also being the hardliners, the neocon, the people who believe in international intervention, yada, 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 all that kind of stuff, the hawks, if you will,
It's the hawks are the pro-Israel lobby, and the main argument, the big argument the hawks make, and this is the one that they make constantly, and it is it's their major emotional appeal. It's the basis for their power. If the argument is that we have to protect America, we have to make sure America doesn't get attacked again, we have to make sure 9/11 is never repeated again, and the key to that is working with Israel. If those same people are now saying, yeah, it's okay to give all of our data to Israel without anything in return, without any protection for individuals, doesn't that undermine the emotional meaning of protect the U.S. national interest?
Well, like I say, there's no meaning. It has no meaning. It's an emotional.
Well, it has an emotional. It doesn't have a lot of
emotional thing.
It definitely has emotional.
Reasonably and arguably, there are a lot of people in the United States who consider Israel our best friend in the world and most worthy of all of our financial support and all of our military support and all of our economic support. And that is critical to the national interests of the United States. There's a case to be made. They're probably one of the few good guys in the Middle East. Justifies total subservience to everything that they want to do and everything that they it's even humorous. The National Intelligence Services do an estimate of all foreign nations to see which ones are pursuing most aggressively spying on the United States. Well, Israel was ranked third after China and Russia as the most aggressive intelligence service against the United States. So there's a real incongruity here.
I would say it's more than an incongruity. I would say it is a direct contradiction of the marketing message of the hawks. The hawks are saying, we're doing all this to protect America. So basically, the way you protect America is by selling America out. Well, that's a conflict.
Well, I don't know if we want to get into the religious aspect of this, but there are a lot of fundamentalist, militant warmongers who believe that Israel is the means for achieving the next coming of Christ, and that we have to protect Israel because Jesus Christ is going to come down to Jerusalem.
Why don't we turn the U.S. government over to the Israeli government? I mean, seriously, if that's what it comes down to, if it really comes down to Israel is ultimately our source of salvation, why don't we just turn the U.S. government over to them? Let's let Israel be our government, because that's what the argument amounts to.
And that's what the policy amounts to in practice. It's not partisan. It's common, maybe a little bit more dominant among Republicans and Democrats, but Democrats see Israel as the future hope of the world for democracy in the Middle East. And so it is sacrosanct. It is, the holy land. And we have to do everything we possibly can, no holds barred, to, protect them and secure their safety and prosperity.
So this raises the question, where does Syria fit into all this with the current chemical weapons mess over there?
Mm-hmm. Here's we have to put it in a context that isn't familiar to a lot of our listeners. The whole Middle East, with the exception of Israel, is a contest between Sunnis and Shia. And the battle is for dominance in the Middle East. Now, the Shiites include Iran, and we converted Iraq from Sunni to Shiite. That's a grand thing for Iran. Assad in Syria is affiliated with the Shiites and Iran and so on, and so is Hezbollah. Well, so Hezbollah is a friend of Assad. that's trying to beat down the Sunnis, who are the Free Syrian Army and the rebels trying to overthrow Assad. So it's a sectarian war that's going on. Now, Israel is in the peculiar position of they want Hezbollah to be fighting in Syria rather than in Israel and creating a ruckus there. But what they fear is that if we have a war and the Sunnis take over, that Hezbollah is going to get the residue of the chemical weapons in Syria, take them down to southern Lebanon, and start throwing them at Israel. So this whole tribal, you know, sectarian warfare in the Middle East, Israel is in the middle of it. I mean, they've got the Shiite Hezbollah to the north, and they've got the Sunni Hamas to the south, and who knows what they've got to the east, and the Palestinian Authority, and so on. So they're caught right in the middle there, and the whole flux between the Sunnis, which is primarily Saudi Arabia, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, and so on, that's the Sunni faction, and the Shiite faction, which is Iran, Iraq, and Syria, and they're battling it out day by day at each one of these so-called Arab Spring things. When it comes down to what's going to happen in Egypt, it's a fight between those two sectarian factions.
The news this past week was that Syria had agreed to turn over their chemical weapons stashes to the Russians and the U.S., and it's not quite clear whether NATO or the U.N. is involved or whatever, but that's at least on the surface what's been going on. But in practice, behind the scenes, and certainly from the critics' point of view, there are real questions about whether that agreement amounts to anything at all. For instance, our friend Charles Faddis, the retired CIA case officer who was on the show last week, third time he was on the show, he wrote an article that was published at andmagazine.com this past week, in which he basically made the case that it is impossible, literally impossible, for us to find out where all the chemical weapons are in Syria, even if Syria agrees to it. He says, sign any deal you want. You will never, ever possibly know where all the chemical weapons have gone, what portion is being turned over, and what portion remains secreted away. And he goes into details about the mechanics of how that operates. But it raises the question. It raises the question of, well, if that's true, and frankly, I trust Charles Faddis a lot more than I trust, you know, the government. If I trust his judgment in this, then it has to raise the question once again: why are we even bothering? What is this anything more than just posturing to make it look good?
Well, here's the thing you have to understand: the Chemical Weapons Convention is an agreement basically among six countries that was put in place after World War II, and they said this is bad shit, and we're going to get rid of our stuff. You get rid of your stuff, and so Russia and the U.S. and all the other countries that actually had chemical weapons agreed that they were going to, you know, eliminate them. It was a mutually advantageous circumstance for them to agree to just get rid of these chemical weapons. And so that's what the convention is. So Syria joined this convention, and they are only, you know, confined by the provisions in the convention that were agreed to by this voluntary cooperative effort. And so there are all kinds of procedures and so on and so forth that they're going through. But as Charles said, there's no way to know exactly where all the chemical weapons are or where they're going to go. In theory, Assad could, although I don't know if it's in his best interest, turn over vast stockpiles of chemical weapons to Hezbollah and let them take it out of the country, take it to Lebanon, and it's a future threat against Israel. That could happen, but at the same time, I'm not sure that that's would be a beneficial thing for him to turn over these chemical weapons to other people. There are all kinds of enforcement provisions, but let me explain one thing.
Well, we got to look quick because we're out of time here.
Yeah, I'll make it very short. The United States had about 1,000 times more chemical weapons than Syria does now, 10 years ago. And we entered this convention, we eliminated 90% of it. So now we only have 100 times more chemical weapons. The convention agreement was that all of them would be eliminated by 2012. The U.S. now says maybe we'll get the rest of it done by 2023. So not even the U.S. and Russia are complying with the terms of this convention.
Which means it's all a great big charade that unfortunately we're going to have to start talking about next time because we're out of time this time. But, Bill, it's been a pleasure as usual.
Sure.
And we'll see you all next time here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.